This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Telos Systems, Telos Audio and Networks, the best way to hear from there. On the web at telos-systems.com. And by Digital Media Technology, supplying professional broadcast equipment to Hong Kong and mainland China. On the web at www.dmtpro.com.
And now, our feature presentation, Twirt.
I just remember it wasn't even that many years ago. Forget about any kind of data. You know, if you were on a transitor site, you were out of touch.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
Well, this week you get a break from me. I'm out of town, but Tom Ray, Chris Tarr, and Chris Tobin will take you on a wild ride.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Well, hello, and welcome to This Week in Radio Tech. Kirk Harnack is not with us tonight. Kirk is flying someplace. He's probably someplace over the Pacific. He's on his way to Hong Kong right now, and knowing Kirk, he'll forget all about our Chinese food order again. He never brings us the authentic stuff. I'm Tom Ray. I'm Vice President of Engineering at Buckley Broadcasting and WOR Radio in New York. And with me, taking a little trip, first of all, out to the Midwest, is Chris Tarr. Good evening, Chris.
Greetings from flyover country.
And Chris, why don't you tell everybody who you are?
I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin.
Excellent, excellent. How's the weather been out there in Madison these days?
It has been gorgeous.
I bet it's been pretty,
you know, mid-70s. We had a little bit of rain, but it's been sunny all day today, and yeah, it's just been gorgeous.
Oh yeah, and the last couple of weeks in New York have been hot but gorgeous, and it's raining right now, but we'll come back to New York. I'm located in the mid-Hudson, or actually in the Hudson Valley, which is about 50 miles north of New York City, and down in New York City is the classy one of the bunch, Mr. Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris.
Hello there. You're too kind. Actually, well, last 2 days have been very nice with the weather.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to last week.
last week it was brutal. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, I know we sound like, pansies. Oh, it was brutal. It was 90 degrees. Oh, my goodness. The humidity was 87%. While I was looking at weather around the world in Baghdad, the low was 84 at 6 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, my God.
The high for the day was 117, and the forecast called for sunny with dust.
Oh, good.
I kid you not.
Man.
Oh. Kid you not. I just had to look around the globe to see what the weather was like. I'm like, sunny with dust. And the graphic is an image of of the sun with what looks like hazy dust particles, brown.
Wow.
I kid you not.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
Well, I was just trying to get it in perspective, so this way I didn't feel too bad. I was like, okay, you know what? Some people do have it worse.
Oh, you bet. And Chris, tell us who you are.
I am I'm a broadcast technologist with the CBS Radio Group here in New York City. We have six radio stations, 3 a.m. and 3 FM, and we have a lot of good times with the formats of Top 40, Oldies, Hot AC, All News, actually two All News, and All Sports. So you can imagine how busy we keep.
Oh, yeah, big time. But what we're doing tonight is Kirk isn't with us, as I said, and our guest kind of fell through, so... It's the Three Musketeers here, and what we're going to do tonight is we're just going to talk about various things. We'll start out talking a little bit about our favorite tools, and I'm not talking about the guy in the studio who tried to burn it down last week. and I think we all know someone like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then we're going to talk about some difficult problems, and gosh knows what else may come up. So anyway, we're glad you're with us, and we'll start talking about our favorite tools. Now, if you're on Facebook and you follow myself or Chris Tobin and or Chris Tarr, you may have noted the other day, I think it was one day last week, Chris Tarr posted that he had tried out the HTC Hero phone, and he thinks the Android platform is pretty cool. Well, I'm here to make him jealous, because as I tell you, I've only had it 24 hours, and this is quickly becoming one of my favorite tools. I got the Sprint HTC EVO 4G last night, and it's already replaced my BlackBerry.
it's taking all I've got to not just go out and buy one, even though I'm now out of contract. and or I'm in contract rather, and so I'd have to pay full price. But I'm literally going, you know, I could probably come up with the money.
and I tell you, if it does what they say it will do, and I'm going to try it this weekend. I just haven't had time yet. It may replace my Sprint data card for my laptop, because if I can couple the laptop into it via Wi-Fi and it works just as well as the Sprint data card, I can like eliminate two things that I have to carry all the time. And I think this is a good thing. So that's my newest favorite tool. Chris Tarr, what do you have these days?
Well, you know, I carry around, I got the Sprint Hero, which is, as you were mentioning, you know, with the VNC and all the data stuff on it and stuff, it's pretty slick. But I've been using my iPad a lot, believe it or not.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I've always been a Mac guy, so I'm pretty comfortable with Macs. And I'll tell you what, I've got a wireless keyboard for the Bluetooth keyboard. It's got all the apps on there for word processing, and it's got a Numbers, which is sort of like Excel.
Hmm.
VNC, VPN, all that kind of stuff. I can literally, you know, VPN into the Transitor remote control and see what's going on from there. It syncs with Exchange for my email. So I really, in fact, I'm going to be going on vacation next week, and I'm going to leave my laptop at home, and I'm just going to bring the iPad with me.
No kidding. That's,
yeah, I mean,
that's interesting.
It works. It works exceptionally well. You know, a lot of the apps that I got for the iPhone for engineering, things like, you know, there's an RF calculator, you know, path loss calculator, all these great little applications work on the iPad as well. So it really is very handy for just the day-to-day stuff, too. And it's so portable that, you know, I can walk out of the Transitor building and I just carry it with me.
Now, do you have the the built-in cellular on that for the data, Chris?
I do not. And, you know, with AT&T now and their data caps and everything, I'm kind of glad I don't, because you could easily, you know, use that all up. I, you know, really, Wi-Fi is so pervasive now that I really haven't been in a situation where I went, oh, boy, I wish I had the cellular data. Okay. Everywhere I've gone so far has Wi-Fi.
That's interesting. Chris Tobin, how about you?
Well, when it comes to smartphones, unfortunately, because of the company I'm employed by, I've got to stick with the BlackBerry in order to stay in communication with our email. So I don't have the luxury of using any of those on the professional level. But I do have the Android platform for home stuff, and boy, that's a heck of an operating system. Gotta like it.
Isn't it? You know, I was looking at it on this little phone, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's very cool.
Yeah, the Droid, I do a lot with the Droid. It's like, wow, if it just wasn't for the corporate regulations, I'd be using it at the office.
Yeah, well, Chris Tarr and I and Chris Tobin, we were talking about this before we started the podcast tonight, that you know, on my BlackBerry, I've got a VNC application, but the way it works is that it kind of takes a snapshot, shows it to you, waits another 5 to 8 seconds, takes a snapshot. So if you,
right.
You know, if you try to switch transmitters or something, you click, you got to wait 5 to 8 seconds to see anything. And I was telling both Chris's, I'm sitting there looking at this phone today with its little VNC app, and I'm watching the transmitter readings bounce. I mean, it was the coolest thing.
Carrier do you have with that one?
That's Sprint.
That's a Sprint one, right? Okay.
Yeah. And you know, Sprint, I initially went with a Sprint phone, oh gosh, I forget how many years ago, when WOR was located down at 1440, because Sprint turns out, for whatever reason, that place in Midtown, Sprint was the only carrier that worked on the 23rd floor.
Yeah, we use Sprint for all of our reporters for the USB modems, the modem, the data plans.
Oh, and you know what's really cool for the Android platform? Comrex just came out with a Comrex Access app for the Droid platform, which I've downloaded but haven't had time to play with. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's
no
what I'm looking
kidding.
Forward to. Yes, they had that at the NAB. They had that program that Chris Bobo and Tom had demonstrated it to me on a smartphone, and actually works really well and sounds really good. And the latency is very minimal.
I'll tell you, carrier-wise, I just switched to Sprint not too long ago to go on the Android platform, and I've been very happy with them. In fact, I moved all the rest of my family over from AT&T, and you know, data-wise, data has been great on that phone, very fast.
Well, I did some research with those folks prior to our purchase for the news operations, and turns out they spent some serious coin building out their network based on data, not voice.
I believe it.
And I'm thinking that's why we're seeing the results we see.
Well, and if you talk to there was a recent interview with Dan Hesse, who's the CEO of Sprint. And one of the things they're talking about is, especially in light of AT&T with their data caps, they're talking about, you know, how they've invested in their data. And really, I think that's how they're going to differentiate themselves from AT&T and Verizon now is through data.
I would believe it because we do have Verizon modems as well, and they're not as robust when it comes to, you know, the you say bandwidth, I guess is the best way to put it. I have noticed a difference in bandwidth and response with laptops and other devices that we use between the two carriers. And Sprint, I would say, 9 times out of 10 performs just above, you know, where Verizon falls short, and you're like, wow, what a difference. But voice-wise and penetration for legacy comms, Verizon still has the largest footprint.
I'll tell you, though, what's really been great is, especially out here in the Midwest where I have transmitter sites in the middle of nowhere, I just remember it wasn't even that many years ago when, forget about any kind of data. You know, if you were out of the transmitter site, you were out of touch. If you had to download a PDF or you had to look up something online, you were completely out of luck. And now, you know, most of my sites have DSL, but I also, you know, you can tether your phone and turn on your computer and use the data from that to, you know, look things up from the manufacturer's websites and things like that. It's just amazing how much in engineering that just the proliferation of these phones has made our job so much easier.
Oh, you bet.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, you go out to the transmitter site now and you can download whatever you need, and it's excellent. I remember the days when you just sat there at the transmitter site and you had the transmitter books and maybe a telephone and you could call the manufacturer, and if you could get somebody on the phone, great. But boy, besides that, you were on your own.
I carry on my iPad, I have PDFs of every piece of gear that I have and then some stored on my iPad. And I was out at a transmitter site that didn't have data, working on a CD-Link STL. And they didn't have the manual, just whipped out my iPad, opened up the PDF, and I was ready to go.
I have an e-reader that I have all my PDFs on. I do the same thing.
Yeah, it's great, yeah.
Yeah, I keep them all on my laptop. It's great.
When I'm at the transmitter sites up at the Empire State Building, which is pretty much catch-as catch-all when it comes to any kind of carrier service up there, the pin, you know, it's like a pin top with a lot of RF, and the e-read is great. I pull out the PDF, I'm like, yeah, here we go, and they're like looking at me going, where'd you get that? Oh, I already have these because I know this environment's not very friendly when it comes to this stuff.
Right,
but it's handy. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, today with the tools that are available, it's wow. I mean, when I think about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, learning this stuff, and 20 years back, it's like if you didn't have the manual going, what you had a Collins transmitter or a Continental, you're like, you had three versions of that manual, and you made sure you kept every one of them.
Oh yeah, and if you made any modifications, you made sure you kept those in the manual, and you made sure you had notes and everything else.
Now today, type it out.
Murphy's Law always worked out where you took the manual back to your office to get on the phone to order some parts, then you'd leave it there. The next time it failed,
exactly.
You got the side, your manual will be back on your desk.
Oh, that's my favorite trick, let me tell you.
Oh, that's true. But for tools that I use at the office or in our tech center and its transmitter, I've got different ones. We have both an analog and AES plants, so it's a mixed bag of things. But like I mentioned on the earlier podcast, the Q-Box, the analog Q-Box and the AES, great little guys to have in your bag when you're walking around the plant. Unbelievable. When you have a problem with audio or anything, you like pop it in, headphones on, XLR in and out. You can generate tone if you have to. Great tool. Another one that I found that coming very handy now with all the datacom stuff we're doing, I don't know if you've heard of it, but Fluke Networks has what they call the IQ calibration. It's a handheld unit. It's about, I think, $2,000. You have people calling up, I don't know, my computer's not working right. We've made changes, cables on the floor, this or that. This will qualify you out to a gig. You could do VoIP qualifications, gigabit Ethernet. It's got termination adapter on it. You plug it in, turn it on. You can measure your length of cable, which pairs are open at which end.
Wow.
It does TDR work. It was worth the investment. I did it 3 years ago. Every time we get a call about something wrong with computers in a certain part of the building, certain group of studios, I'm like, you know what? Before you do anything else, just unplug the cable. Let's put the tester on and see what we get. I can't tell you how many jumper cables we have found defective because of, you know, rolling on the chair, who got it caught in the desk drawer, you know, things like that. Saved hours of trouble. Plug it into a computer and print out everything.
Yeah, I don't have one that's fancy, but even just the Fluke Cat 5 tester that has the digital readout on it, that has the TDR and stuff on that, you'd be amazed how many problems you can solve with one of those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is the handheld unit that I have. I know they have a couple of models. But this one actually we found worked better than some of the other types of testers that are out that I think just look at DC only, not the RF component.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've compared them with cheaper models that people claim, oh, they work great. And guess what? This unit found a lot of faults. The other ones didn't. So you'd be sitting there going, well, it's not the cable. It must be the computer. And it turns out the opposite.
You know who we should get on some night, see if we can get, talk, oh, gosh, I can't remember his first name now, Lampen.
Oh, yes, the Belden Man.
Oh, yeah. Remember, I think Chris, he came to SBE 15, and we figured, okay, he's going to talk about cable. And, oh, my God, he went on for 2.5 hours about Cat 5 cable, and we all just sat there, like, in a trance. It was like, this guy's incredible, and the facts he came out with.
The best part was it reinforced, because we had talked at that meeting about Cat 5 cable being used for audio applications in the broadcast environment, how people just couldn't grasp doing it. It was like, no, this is wrong. It's got to be shielded. It's got to be this. And he comes in and goes, let me dismiss all those theories and tell you exactly how wire works. And it's not about the wire. It's about the termination you put on the wire.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Tommy, he was like, everything, we just sat there going, and he backed it up with facts. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Everything was a formula that you could look up. This was not some black art that he was talking about. No, some, I mean, literally, and I know from working with some of the products from other companies that make these little bolums to carry video across twisted pair, and you could do RF. It works.
Oh, yeah.
It does. And I've been using Cat 5 for audio transport all over the place for years. And, I got yelled at by people in the field. I'm doing outdoor events, and you got these, sound guys coming up to me. What are you doing? What's this Cat 5? I'm using it to transport audio. What? I did it. And they heard the other end. They're like, that can't be. Yeah, it worked great. And then Dan Braverman comes along with Studio Hub products and just makes it easier for me to use it.
Yeah, well Steve, Steve Lampen, that's the name. And you're right with the Dan Braverman radio system stuff. We've done some mock-ups of remote setups out at the transmitter site, and of course, Chris, you know where the transmitter is. We got 50 kilowatts of us on site. Yeah. You're aimed right over us. We've got WLIB behind us, and we've just plugged everything in with Cat 5, and it's like it just sits there and works. You don't hear a peep out of the RF, and it amazes me. It really does. But Steve Lampen, he had all kinds of facts and figures about noise and common mode and how the twist affects things, and boy, was he fascinating.
And you know what? To go right along with that, remember SBE 15 New York chapter had the meeting at Middle Atlantic Labs. And what about that demonstration? What that was based on, again, how you terminate the cable.
That and the the fact that he had a whole bunch of light bulbs, like compact fluorescents. And
oh, yes.
It was just fascinating to see the current waveform that came off of all these things and then take a look at the dimmable version, and it was almost a pure sine wave.
Yes. Yeah, he was actually demonstrating to us that the compact fluorescents were actually inefficient compared to the others. And it cost the electric companies more to supply electric for those using compact fluorescents than the other dimmables.
Yeah, because of the fast rise time of the current coming in, and then it kind of drifted off. But it was also
noise.
They were working on some new wire enclosure. I'm not going to say conduit. It was similar to a conduit, but it was like a wire enclosure that to prevent stray pickup from the magnetic fields from these lines. And
yes.
and what they were doing was they were showing. They were taking a pure sine wave, which a regular incandescent bulb will give you a current wave that's a pure sine wave. But they were using these compact fluorescents to generate sawtooth waves, and it was absolutely amazing.
They were applying for, a standard with the National Electrical Code folks.
Yes, yep, that's exactly
what they were doing. It was just wild. I mean, demonstrating ground loops, the mystery, if you will, of some of what they call ground loops, and the reasons why you don't ground things a certain way, that is the current thinking. Remember that with the racks?
Yes. Yep.
And how let's get this straight. This wasn't paper only. This was literally in person, live demonstration with test equipment, calibrated everything to demonstrate what you should do and what you should not do when it comes to grounding both electrical and audio.
I tell you, Chris Tarr would love wandering around Mid-Atlantic with Bob Schluter in the place. Oh, my God, what a toy store.
That sounds awesome. It really does.
No, it was absolutely. I mean, I wish we could have videotaped it for an educational class, because I don't think I could repeat or explain with the great detail that he did and get the point across. I mean, it was just something you had to see, witness what he did, how he did, listen to it, watch. I mean, every sense, visual, aural, your brain comprehending speech. It was just everything had to be taken in to get where he was going. It was just a lot. I mean, you definitely left with your brain, you know, swelling and hurting.
Oh, you bet. What a great meeting. Why don't we wander off and let's chat. Why don't we chat a little bit about a couple of difficult problems we've had lately? I was telling both Chris's that over at WR we had an interesting thing come up Monday. All of a sudden, Master Control calls and says, you know, boy, the antenna readings are out in left field. And, oh, yeah, they were out in left field. So we took a little trip out to the transmitter site, and I've got a new assistant, Dennis. Dennis is a great guy. He's very young. He's just learning RF, and we walked out there, and, you know, of course, the antenna monitor is, you know, off scale, and he's, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And I said, get away from the phaser. Because a lot of people, the first thing they do when they go out there, they don't think, and they just start cranking on the phaser. And I was like, no, we don't want to do that. And if we do, we want to write everything down so we know where to put things back. But we did a, we took a look at the Common Point Bridge, and it was sitting at 50J0 perfectly. So that told me right there it wasn't the antenna system. We went out and measured base currents, and then we went out and did field readings and showed that the antenna was in. So we've got an intermittent thing with the sample system, but I'm going to try and catch it tomorrow when I'm out there and find out if it's the antenna monitor or it could be a sampling toroid, because even though WOR uses almost half-wave towers, there are several issues because of our neighbors. We have, you know, Chris Tobin's 1010 winds, and we've got WLIB, which are at 1010 and 1190, respectively. And the WOR towers, being 171 degrees, are way too tall at those two frequencies to comfortably detune at the bottom. So we've got detuning skirts and everything else. And we found during tune-up, and we tuned up the system with sample loops, that we had a minor bandwidth issue on WOR with the decoupling coils in place. And also, we couldn't quite get the WLIB detuning where we wanted it. So when we pulled those out, we got them right down to zero current at the bottom of the tower. And it just worked out really well. So we ended up using a toroidal current transformers for the monitoring system. And we measure that right where we measure the base currents at the towers, so I can do a direct base current comparison and see if the monitor's on. But it's going to be interesting to see if it's the toroid or the antenna monitor. Our consultant told me he had a station not too long ago with an antenna monitor, same make and pretty much same vintage as the one we have, and it went bad. It had a tower input module go bad, so it's we'll see tomorrow. We'll see if I can narrow it down and then figure out what to do.
I had a similar issue, and I actually used it as a just like you did, kind of as a training thing for my assistant, where the antenna monitor was way out, but again we went and checked base currents and you know the lesson I was teaching was don't always trust what the meters are telling you, and we went out to base currents and monitor points, everything fine. It just turned out that we had a bad connector. We use loops on ours, and we just had a bad connector. And, but I'll tell you his first response and mine was first time I worked at with a DA system. Your first response is generally to go run over to the knobs and start cranking, and you can quickly get yourself into trouble. So I've kind of over the years learned to, verify first before we start to crank on things, because sometimes it could just be as simple as, you know, what the meter's telling you is a lie.
Exactly. You know? And Chris Tobin?
Phasers, when I have a problem with my directional, last thing I touch is the phaser knobs.
Mm.
I go to every other component that I know. If I look at it, if I remove it, I can put it back. It's not going to change things. Because that's the, in our case anyway, on my station, two pattern directional. The last thing you want to do is turn a knob on the wrong pattern.
Oh, boy.
Well, generally, it's never, you know, the problem almost is never worthy of having to crank knobs. You know, I mean, if you're cranking knobs, it's usually something else that you're compensating for that has failed, you know, if you're making any major adjustments. So,
that's true. Absolutely.
You know, if you're way out all of a sudden one day, you know, really change, you know, tweaking the knobs on the phaser is probably at best a temporary fix.
Well, I had an operator one day call me and say, I'm looking at the readings on the remote control. We take them automatically. The the anchors on the air don't really take readings, but we have a person in the tech center that checks all the transmitter sites remotely, and you know, go quickly through the readings. If anything's out of tolerance, the remote control will definitely call. And happened to notice that the reference and the meter, the points were just on the phase monitor were just going up and down, but in a strange way. And I said, "What do you mean by strange?" And I wasn't near a phone or a computer at the moment. I was at a meeting that I purposely turned everything off and kept it away so I could stay focused. But when I came out, I called back the message and like, "What are you talking about?" Turns out they were panicking. They were like, "We got to go out to the transmitter and check on things." I said, no, leave it be. Just you're okay. No, the FCC. Nope, calm down. It's well within 3%. We're okay. Just stay away. I get out there, and there's this huge, had to be, I don't know, 300-foot crane doing construction work. And Tom's aware out there in the Meadowlands area that the new construction was going on about a year ago with the stadium
in the
Meadowlands.
Yep.
And it just happened that this crane was in a right spot in the forward direction of my array, that as it swung around, dropped its cable down to grab stuff, I guess it grounded itself just right, and became a detuning.
Oh, Jesus.
I kid you not, I actually opened the door to the building. I was like, okay, I don't see anything in this direction. Let me look toward the city. And I'm like, oh, look, there's a big crane. Grabbed the laptop, remote it in, sat in the car in the field, and watched the crane swing from left to right. As it did, I'd watch my metering go from positive to negative. In unison with the swing of the crane, I was like, wow. You know, you read about these things, and sometimes you're lucky to catch it, but I'm actually watching it like, this is wild. And then 2 days later, I get a phone call from some company saying they're complaining about tools arcing and stuff. I'm like, yeah, you're only about 200 feet from the front of my array. I'd recommend you just wear gloves and try and ground the crane when you can. What?
What?
They were drawing arcs off the tools.
Oh, jeez. Remember, Chris, when they started building the Xanadu project? And Chris Tarr, if you've never seen, I'll have to send you a picture of this building. This has to be the ugliest building you have ever seen in your life. I mean, it looks like the 1970s exploded. That's the color scheme. That is the color scheme, yes. And it's about, I'm going to say, Chris, it's what, about 500 feet from the old WEPN towers?
Yes, about 500 feet, exactly.
And I remember when they started building that was about the same time we started building the WRR transmitter facility. And that, of course, was before the developer that was in the area where we were supposed to be, which was going to be a golf course. They've since gone bankrupt and they've kind of left town. But the same crews were kind of working on both sites. And I was talking to the crane crews one day, and I said, look, when you're over there, I says, if I were you, I would not leave those cranes up, you know, for a weekend, because boy, those, you're 500 feet from 50 kilowatts, man. That's a hell of an antenna. As a matter of fact, they had a company, we've had him do RF seminars for SBE15. Rich Strickland he had to go out and do RF measurements every week. And he told us about that. And some of the numbers he was coming up with, it was more flabbergasting for the amount of RF that was there. But one weekend, they left the cranes up. I think it was a holiday weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a holiday weekend.
And when Tuesday came around, there was no activity going on the site because they had to rebuild both cranes that they left up because all of the nylon pulleys had melted.
Oh man.
Now you have to remember now, here in this location in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, is where you have several, maybe half a dozen class, you know, full 50 kilowatt AM stations whose antenna arrays are pointing in the direction of New York City. So if you can, you know, do the math, depending on the efficiency of the towers, and all of them are very close to 90 degree towers, if not greater. So, you know, the forward array, it's 50,000 watts leaving the transmitter, roughly, depending on the losses in your antenna system. But when you do the gain, you know, we'll say gain over isotropic dipole for those of us in RF, you're talking, you know, 150,000, maybe 200,000 watts of RF going in a direction toward the city.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, inverse law, by the time it reaches the city, it's very safe. But if you're directly in the, is it the E field, I think it's called? You're directly in front. It's like, you know, it's pretty hot. And for some reason, folks just don't pay attention, even they're told. And to follow this storyline, there was a radio station, Queens, formerly known as WQXR, a classical station of the New York Times. And in Maspeth, Queens, which it's still a transmitter there, but it's now under different ownership. And the engineer for that station, Rodney, who's a contract engineer currently and a very good one, he told me a story. There was construction taking place across the street for a new building. And again, a crane. Nobody paid attention. He tried to tell him. Went to the local zoning board meetings, tried to explain what was going on. Nobody wanted to hear of it. They, too, experienced a problem 2 or 3 days into the project because they didn't pay attention. And again, 50,000-watt AM, you're directly across the street. As the crow flies, maybe 300 feet from the tower, do the math. You can't avoid it. It's like a gentleman I learned a long time ago as an apprentice to, he said to me, he goes, listen here, kid. One thing you need to remember when it comes to transmitters and broadcasting, whether it's TV or radio or shortwave. I said, what's that? Physics. You change it, it's going to hurt you.
Yep.
Try to change it, it's going to hurt you. I'm like, okay, I'll remember that. And boy, he was right.
But you mentioned Rodney before. Chris Tarr will appreciate this. Week before last, we had the SBE 15. We do an annual barbecue the Thursday before Memorial Day every year. And we usually do it at the WR transmitter site because we're out in the middle of nowhere. It's saying we can carry on and have a great time. Well, 2 days before the barbecue, I get this note from the guys over at Clear Channel because Rodney had been dating this woman who worked over at Clear Channel, and they said, hey, Rodney's getting married this weekend.
That's right.
And we were like, I said, really? Then we have to do something nasty. They found a website. Don't ask me how they found it. I think they punched it into Google. You can actually get a fake airline ticket.
Yes.
They got Rodney an airline ticket to get out of town one way to Mogadishu. and they gave it to me, so of course, you know, I do the introduction. I'm the chairman of the chapter, and we do the I did this big build up and how, you know, we found out that someone's getting married, and the crowd oohs and ahs and awe, isn't that sweet, and Rodney, what a great guy he is. And Rodney, I said, I want you to know we spared every expense, and he's sitting there eating it up, and all of a sudden it was like, huh, what? We hand him the ticket. Oh my! I thought he was going to die.
Oh, that's funny. And
just remember, though, for Rodney, with Rodney, when you least expect it, he will get his revenge.
Oh, not a problem. I look forward to it.
Well, given our buddies at Clear Channel here in New York, we know exactly what the antics they're up to.
But Chris had been talking about cranes and such before, and that big crane when they were building the stadium. And incidentally, if anyone is a football fan or a Giants fan, there's only about a quarter of Giants Stadium left right now. They're taking the old one apart piece by piece. We had our New York State alternative inspection, which sounds kind of funny, but WR is a New York station, even though the transmitter is located in New Jersey. And we went out, and I made a mistake. There's this park over in Jersey City where we have one monitor point, and there are two entrances to the park, which kind of look alike with one exception, that one of them actually has this little jungle gym across the street. And the inspector and I are shooting the bull, and I got out at the wrong place, and the monitor point was twice what it should have been. It's like, oh my God. I mean, we went back, we looked around, we saw those cranes over at Giant Stadium. It's like, no, they're off to the side. That can't be causing our problem. Turns out that's when we pulled out the pictures of the monitor point, and I was in the wrong place reading it. We went back, and it was fine. But were we cursing out the guys over there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have the same kind of thing with two monitor points, as a matter of fact, at a park. And same kind of thing, two entrances that are almost identical. And finally, what I ended up doing is I just ended up writing the GPS coordinates down so that I could make sure I was at the right one. But I also, when I go out and do my monitor points quarterly, I bring marker point, like survey marker paint, the pink stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just always mark where I stand so that generally, even, you know, that paint is durable enough that even after the winter, you know, I can at least see the faded mark that I made the last time I was there and kind of refresh it. So, but you know, that's, it was kind of funny because a consulting guy that I've worked with in the past, you know, that's always the joke. It's like, if we can find a monitor point at either, you know, a cemetery, because those never change.
Right.
Or, you know, in the city, a fire hydrant, because they never move those either. So, right. You know, that's usually what we try to shoot for.
Actually, in New York City, you'd never know with those. But
that's true.
But Chris Tobin, yeah. the recently, I think it was with it was with Wins. You guys went through and did a Moment of Methods proof, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, we're actually still conducting that. We're doing monitor point measurements this week. I think we have about 55 to do.
Oh my God! What was that like?
The methods of moment is an opportunity for directional stations to tighten up, if you will, maybe let out the pattern so that you can maximize your coverage area. You do not change your interference parameters as far as protecting the stations on your license. It just allows you to sort of, you know, push the edge, make sure everything's in place. And it was actually a lot of fun. You don't get to do this often. So when you're working with a RF engineer and you're in the field and working with test equipment that, you know, you use maybe once or twice in your lifetime, you take advantage of it. It was 13 nights between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. We did the work because it's sort of like you do it. There's a computer model that the consultants put all the parameters into, figure out what should be, where and everything, parameters from inductance to impedance, the towers, the coils, everything it should be. And then you have to go out and prove it. The problem is once you start, because you're going to start changing components, and once you start, you can't stop. So wow. First two nights was sort of like, all right, guys, get everything in place, get all the coils that we need, the changes we're going to make, and let's start looking at it. Because at our particular radio station, we have two patterns. It's a DA2, so daytime pattern and a nighttime pattern. Then we have two non-directional patterns for when we have to do work in the fields. It's approximately 10 different tuning networks that are required to do all that work.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and you said what, 55 monitor points?
I was given a number of 50, 55 has to be measured, but I think it was just a more of just like an exaggeration. I think it's like about 20. What our consulting engineer, very, very good guy, and I mean, I watched him on a piece of paper, pencil, calculator.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, you're talking
about.
We're using two. And I've worked with folks like him, gentlemen like him in the past on other projects with FM and stuff. And it's just, you know what? It's a combination of a passion for what you do, time doing it, and being able to go to dozens of locations to see the different, you know, the dozen different ways an RF signal can be generated and transmitted. He called me on the two-way radio. I'm at the base of the tower in the tuning box. They'll say, okay, give me a reading on the impedance bridge. So, you know, you do the little tuning, you check it. It's like, you know, R48 J50 minus 50. He's like, okay, tell you what, we need a little more reactance. Turn the knob on the capacitor, variable vacuum capacitor, a quarter turn to the right. You should see roughly, you know, this new reading. Can I tell you, 5 out of 5 times, the guy was on the money within like, you know, half an ohm.
Isn't he scary?
He's just out of control. I'm like, whoa. But again, it just comes from, I'm convinced, passion. Because he would look at me and go, look, this is not rocket science. Trust me. Here's the formula. It's real simple. You plug it in, you get it. He goes, but I've noticed that networks like these on these type of antenna systems sometimes need a little extra sort of like, oh, you know what? Yeah, the computer model says X. I'm going to go X to the 1. And he goes, 9 times out of 10, that's where it has to be. I'm like, okay, I get it. I'm telling you, 13 nights of working with this guy and watching this, it's you know, he's an artisan. He's a craftsman. I mean, it's one of these things you do not give up the opportunity. You do it. Trust me, 13 nights was like, threw my body clock totally out of whack. But you know.
what amazed me with the old WRRA, when I started at WOR 13 years ago now, we had a 75-ohm system. And we did a lot of work on the old antenna system to, you know, broadband it a little bit and make things a little bit smoother. And we bought a Harris DX50 transmitter. And I said, you know, I can't see asking these guys to take it and tune it up to 75 ohms. I said, you know, it's easy enough. The old Continental transmitter we were keeping, it's easy enough to tune that to 50. I said, while you're here, I want to know what I have to do to make this 50 ohms. So we're there that night, and he brought out his calculator and did a couple of calculations, and he took a piece of masking tape and he opened the back of the phaser, and there was this big coil. I tell you, I've always wanted to make whiskey with that coil. I mean, Chris Starr, this thing is huge. But he took a piece of masking tape and he marked it. He says, all you got to do is move this tap here. I said, yeah, what about the capacity? He said, you'll be within a couple of months. Just move it here. And a couple of months later, the transmitter came in. And I went into the phaser. I moved the tap to that point where the tape was. I closed the door. I was 52 ohms J0.
Oh,
geez. And I'm sitting there. It was one of those moments, you know.
You know, it's kind of a common thread with these guys. You know, I know some people who are like that with AM too, and they all say, "Oh, yeah, it's not rocket science." You know, you just watch what they do, and you go, "No, it is."
It is. I worked years ago. I don't know how many people remember this technology called FMX.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that was the attempt to reduce the noise that you get from an FM stereo signal outside of your protected contour. And it's companding the L minus R. It was an interesting technique. I think the companding ratio was a little too aggressive. That's why it failed to work. But I had an opportunity to be a test station for this technology because we happened to be in the backyard of the inventors who came up with it. So we would do midnight runs driving around in a van with an antenna sticking out of the van with a field strength meter, which, trust me, local authorities don't take kindly to if you don't tell them in advance. Yeah, I got pulled over twice and tried to explain why there's a van full of old guys with glasses, gray hair, and a young guy driving, and this thing sticking out through the ceiling of a van. It's a rented van. It's rented. And it's weird guys with equipment in the back. Oh, yeah, it was a scene out of a movie. But the group came to me and said, look, we need to do one more test. It requires pulsing your FM transmitter to measure group delay. I'm like, okay, that's a 10,000-watt transmitter we're going to pulse. Do you want to do it at full power or half power? Oh, no, we do it at full power. Really? Okay, after talking with the director of engineering for the company, who was totally on board, and goes, oh, yeah, I know what they're going to do. Yeah, that's no problem. The guy's going to come up. He's a consulting engineer, a former RCA engineer out of Camden, New Jersey. He's now consulting. He's been around for 55 years, a little bit. Guy comes in right out of the military. You know, this guy gets out of his car, takes a look. He's got the cigar. I mean, buzz cut. I'm like, this is too funny. Comes up to me, goes, kid, your site? I said, yeah. Okay, what do you got? I got a rototiller, ERI, single bay antenna, FM, 1 5/8. It's a Continental 10 kilowatt, blah, blah, blah. All right, tell you what it's going to be. Group delay is going to look like this. Takes out a napkin, pencil. Again, the rocket science that it's not. Writes down, he goes, these are the numbers we're going to get. I always do this before I go into the building just to prove that this transmitter, good design. I like him. And I want to make sure I don't lose. He goes, I want to make sure I don't lose the bet. I'm like, what bet is that? He goes, not with you, kid. The guy that hired me, he doesn't believe me that this transmitter is going to pass what he needs, and he's telling me otherwise. I'm like, this is – now, mind you, it's 1 a.m. in the morning. It's a summer night. It's very hot. I just learning some of the newest technology. I'm going, yeah, okay, by the way, guys, my backup transmitter, when I put it back on, I hope it does work, and my primary continues to work after you pulse it. Pulls out $20,000 worth of HP networking analyzing gear. I look at this like, whoa. You know, I mean, it was wild. It was the best. You know, Smith charts right there. You could see it. Plugs into the transmitter. You disconnect the exciter. Does the whole thing. I watched 10,000-watt FM transmitter pulsing at full power.
Wow.
That in itself is just wild. Numbers come out. He goes, all right, it's like a game show now. Read me the numbers. I said, don't you want to? No, please. I want to make sure I'm not accused of altering the game plan. All right, I read the numbers. Again, can I tell you, within 5 microseconds of his readings.
Wow.
I go, how did you? He goes, trust me, Continental, these transmitters, they build them. There's a reason why they work and last as long as they do. ERI, they know their antenna design. They don't do that funky stuff that the other guys do. And I said, yeah, but what? He goes, no, that's all, and I won't say the word, malarkey. He's like, no. This is how it works. This is why it's consistent. This is why you get the performance you need. I'm like, okay, all right, I'll take your word for it. That was 5 nights of just sheer fun. And the military stories I had to hear from him about, yeah, transmitters, antennas, please, let me tell you something. You want to light up a building? You want to do something? Here's how you do it. I'm like, whoa, don't tell me too much. I may get in trouble with that information.
Well, your story.
But again, like Chris pointed out, yeah, it's not rocket science. The people that do it for a living and have done it for 20, 30, 40 years and get a chance to go to, 1,200 different locations to try out their ideas.
Right?
I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, you know, there's Mark Mueller, who's I think he's doing, is it seven towers on a single DA? He's diplexing. Yeah. It's not like five or six. It's crazy up in Minnesota. And, you know, there's if you go to broadcastengineering.info, my site, he's posted some pictures and there's like 50 some traps on there. And he's like, oh, yeah, no. I mean, once you get one, it's like you're just adding on others. There's really nothing to it. And I'm sitting there going,
that's exactly what I've been told.
Math involved, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, because I have to trap out two other radio stations in my vicinity. Mm-hmm. Tom's station, and WLIB at 1190. And I'm sitting there listening to the coils sing away with my station, his station, and the third station. And the consultant goes, yeah, you know what? That one that we're rejecting, that's a little too much. We can change that. How do you know? I could tell by the level of modulation of the coil. Okay. I am not going to question that one. I just like, that's the black art. That's the, whoo. And sure enough, again, like Tom experience. Yeah, do me a favor. We'll power down, change the coil sitting to this, and we'll power up and see how it goes.
Right here on. It is. He's plexing seven radio stations, seven AMs on one DA. And there are now 51 total traps on it.
Wow.
Nice.
Oh my, it's crazy, and it all works. But you know, I said, you know, how, I mean, 7 days. Like after the first two or three, it's easy because you're just, you know, you're just adding more traps and stuff on there. And but you know, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, it looks like this black magic. And you know, to him, it's just like, oh, it's real easy. It's just simple math. Like, man, I have a hard time doing one DA, let alone seven on one DA. You know, it's crazy.
I tried to do some of the math on my directionals, the two patterns, and I was like, okay, I got halfway there before I started to bleed from the eyes. I was like, okay, this is just, I don't do this enough to be able to know all the proper calculus.
Well, you,
but yet, you know, I can tune up a two-way, you know, a ham duplexer if you want, or a couple mm-hmm. other things, no problem.
Well, when we started with our system, they showed me the notebook, you know, that started from, here's a blank page, we're going to design a directional antenna system. And it was amazing to see the calculations and the component values, and everything is fairly close to what it was. And it's mind-boggling with the way some of these guys work. It really is. And it's got to be just all experience.
Oh, Tom, you know the guy I'm talking about. I work.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if we can say his name or not, or company, but
hey, great guy, great company, great people, all of them.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, I'd say, 80% passion. The other 20% is just, okay, you got to learn something from, you know, school or whatever and experience. But the passion, I mean, I could see it because he was sitting there, we're tuning at the phaser cabinet trying to get the readings in, you know, bring the numbers in. And he'd crank away. He's like, no, I know I could do better. And he'd spin it out. And you watch the numbers go, wee, all the way to the other end. You're like, yeah, but that's way out. He goes, don't worry. Turn some other knobs. Comes back. He's like, it's like two, if you could picture two hands on the knobs, like about 5 feet apart, he's just sitting there spinning around and, you know, you're waiting for that line to come. It's alive. That's the look in his eyes. It was great. You don't see that anymore. You know,
it's no, not at all.
It was great.
Well, we had one of his guys when we were tuning up the OR array and not only did I learn something, we had a good time. You know, as you know, we have the barbecue at the site because we hold the SBE barbecue there. And, you know, we'd show up, you know, we couldn't take it off till around midnight, but we'd show up around 9 o'clock at night and we'd throw burgers and chicken on the grill and we'd sit there and eat and shoot the bull and tell stories and, figure out the game plan for the night and go out and do it. And 9 times out of 10, what he said was how it worked.
It was great.
And I'll tell you, you know, the one thing that's common among engineers is they all know how to eat.
Oh yeah,
need fuel.
I have a grill up at one of our tower sites too, and that's always a lot of fun. You know, doing a little grill up before we do actually do some work.
Oh, you bet. And let's see what else have we got going on out there. The you know, it was funny. Somebody said to me the other day when I mentioned that we were having the sample system issue at OR, they said, maybe somebody went out and stole your ground system. I said, you know, in that swamp, more power to them. I don't think they'd come out with anything because they're not coming out.
No.
Right.
Along with those 13 nights that I did, I counted a dozen different muskrats, half a dozen snapper turtles, a couple of carp, and a few other unidentifiable species out there. It was interesting.
Isn't it amazing what you find 6 miles from Manhattan?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we have a fox on the property. He comes out usually around 2 o'clock. He walks through the parking lot.
No way. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, usually with a rabbit in his mouth.
out here in Wisconsin, we have deer out in my back where my towers. I have a 5-tower array, and we commonly see deer and all sorts of wildlife out there. It's we see it every day.
You have any problem, Chris, with the deer with the ground system or with anything around the bottoms of the towers?
No, because I mean it's all fenced off, so they can't get in there. So we really haven't had any issues with that. You know, we have mice, but other than that, they pretty much stay away. It's kind of a marshy area back there. And we have some paths and stuff, and I certainly see them out there. But yeah, I really haven't had any issues with them getting into the tower fences or anything.
Yeah. My favorite, thing around the transmitter site is when springtime comes and, you find the first bees.
Oh, I'll tell you, I just had an issue this past weekend with bees in an LNB. In a dish, and we ended up putting a piece of fiberglass screen over it and a pipe clamp to keep it closed up. But sure enough, you know, our sports feed for our sports station started cutting out, and I know what that is when that happens. And you know, so sure enough, I got to get in there and spray and then run and then wait for it to clear out, and then I get the tool up in there and ducking the wasps as they come flying out of there, and you're trying to get all the stuff cleaned out, and it happens all the time.
Well, we had starting in February, the end of February of this past winter was pretty bad in the New York area. And around that, it was before that time that I kind of was starting to have trouble with one of the security cameras on the building. And it was like, it was too cold. It was too snowy. And I was like, there ain't no way I'm going up there. Well, springtime came. And of course, I'm looking at the camera on the monitor, and I'm seeing activity, shall we say. And I said, oh, good, bees. So I went to one of the local home improvement stores. Well, actually, it's a big chain home improvement store for bee spray, and I found this foaming stuff. And it was great because it would shoot about 35 feet, so I just stood on the ground, and I aimed it at the camera enclosure, and I squeezed, and it hit, and all of a sudden just poof, this big thing of foam came, and the whole thing was encased in foam. And I said, okay, I think I'll come back later, so... 20 minutes later, I came back, and the foam had dissipated, and I had a whole bunch of dead bees, and I said, cool.
one of our towers. This is just a funny sight. One of our towers, we have a metal box where we've coiled up the sample line, and they have it enclosed and everything. But we had some mice decided to move in.
Uh-oh.
So I'm out there with my assistant, Tony. He's kind of a big guy. He's from Minnesota, and he climbs up on the ladder, opens the box, and there's these mice staring back at him. And his first reaction is to yell at them. Get out! Get out! And you know, obviously, there's no way they can get out because they're out at the bottom of the box. So, you know, here's this big, you know, big beefy guy with his gloves on trying to get these mice as they're running around the bottom of this box, grabbing them, pulling them out, like yelling at him about being evicted, and you know, with this Minnesota accent. He's like, yeah, get out of this box. Oh yeah, you're out of here. Get out of here, you mice. And just yelling. And we're in this residential neighborhood, and
oh no,
you know, people are looking at us, and he's like this crazy guy standing on a ladder picking mice out of this metal box and throwing them out of the field. It was hilarious. Gotta love wildlife.
Well, I tell you, one of the it was funny, but it wasn't funny. One of the funniest things I encountered, it wasn't a wildlife thing, but at a had a friend at one point. He owned a station. I'm not going to say where, but it was he always wanted a 50 kilowatt station, and he found a way to fit this 50 kilowatt station in if he had towers just slightly under 90 degrees. So he had a problem with the sample system one day, and he thought it was the antenna monitor. He sent it into Potomac, and it came back. It was the same problem. So he calls me up. He says, could you give me a hand? I said, yeah, sure. Said, well, the other symptom was, believe it or not, it was 1,000 watts night and 50 kilowatts day. And when they turned the 50K rig on in the morning, it would trip off on a Viswar trip. So I went out and I brought an RF probe, and I said, well, let me see what I'm getting back on the sample lines. You know, if I know it's a half volt per amp out of the toroid, so let me see what's happening here. I took off the connector for tower 3 and measured it and got about what I expected. I pulled off the connector for 2. I pulled off the connector for 1, and it arced to the chassis. And I said, yeah. So we went out to the tuning house, and the sample line came up in the tuning house, came out of a PVC conduit, came up and curved, and there were four vacuum capacitors, if I remember correctly, mounted between these two metal plates. And it came up, and it swept up, and it was just touching one of the metal plates and went up to the toroid. And I took a look at it and said, yeah, I think you wore through the outer insulation here on the jacket, and you probably cooked the toroid, so we got to pull the toroid, and we got to, you know, dress this sample line. I says, you know, can we come back tonight at midnight? Of course, he owned the station, and he says, let's just shut it off. And, okay, your station. So he shuts it off, and we proceed to struggle and get the toroid out and take a look, and yeah, sure as heck, the jacket had been worn through, and I'm getting ready to dress the thing back, and he says, well, station's been off the air long enough. I'm going to turn it back on. I said, no, we have to redress the sample line. No. I'm going to turn it back on. Whatever. It's your radio station. So he goes back. I decided I'll stay out here at the tuning house. So I stood in the door. And his site was located in a place where cell phone, there was a dead spot for cell phones. And we had no way to communicate except to wave and use hand signals. So he goes back in the building, and I'm watching the base current meter, and I see it come up and go down. So obviously the transmitter tripped off on a Viswire, and it came up, and the station ID hit. And you know how you hear the coils sing?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't sound right. It sounded like he had the analog modulation along with IBOC, and there was no IBOC in those days. And it was like, something's not right here. And about 15 seconds later, the sample line burst into flames.
Wow.
So I'm sitting there, and he's standing outside the building with this grin on his face, and I'm waving like a maniac, and he's just standing there. Finally, I looked. Thank God he had a fire extinguisher in the building. I grabbed it, took it out, held up the fire extinguisher, and sprayed it, and all of a sudden, he got this look of panic on his face. When it went in, I saw the ammeter drop and sprayed everything, and it was like, I told you we had to dress the sample line. But I told you we had to dress the sample line.
Oh, man.
oh, Lordy. But anyway, that's one of my horror stories, and anybody have anything else to add? Because we're coming up to the end of our time here, guys.
Well, during my 13 nights of Moments of Method, we came across the one of the tuning boxes, we're unable to tune it properly. You go through all the measurements, you're like, wow, we just can't seem to get the numbers where we want them. So it was time to visually inspect the components in the box. Actually, they're small little buildings. I shouldn't say just a box. Copper clad inside and metal cages to somehow manage the RF and keep the detuning from happening. And we're looking at one of the vacuum capacitors, figure about the size of a coffee can. And I'm looking at it, and I go, and it's a glass capacitor. So you know there's a little nipple on there for the when they blow the glass and extract the air out of it and stuff. And you're like, why is there a second? It was a hole.
Oh, geez.
We had a flashover or some kind of arc take place in this tuning house. And the capacitor, I think, was located on the output circuit. It was a shunt to ground. There was a hole in the glass, but it was melted. So it never had a chance to shatter.
Wow.
It actually augmented at a temperature, of course, had to be high enough to melt glass, and put a hole right in it as if you cut it out with a glass cutter. I mean, you could put your finger in there and touch the metal part of the capacitor.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I was like, now that's a new one. Usually you come back to a black glass or shattered glass. But
yeah.
That one, yeah, this looked like it was made this way.
That's why
we missed it. The first time we walked through, we're like, I don't see anything wrong. And we're like, can't get the tuning right. There's something wrong. And we physically looked again, like, oh, my goodness. That was a classic.
I hope you saved
that. Oh, we did. Oh, yeah, it's a
paperwork. I'd like to see a picture of that. That's cool.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
Wow.
We all stood there mystified at 3 o'clock in the morning going, wow. Then we realized it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, we got to get back on the air in 60 minutes. Quick. Put the new cap in and get back out there and start tuning.
Well, that sounded like at WOR we got hit by lightning once, and Of course, you know, Chris Tobin's stations like mine, you've got a boatload of capacitors and stuff out in the tuning houses because of all of the detuning and such. And everything pointed to Tower 2, so we went out there, and nothing was obvious. It was not obvious. And I was like, okay, so we started pulling capacitors out. And I think that tuning house had 25 vacuum capacitors. The 22nd one was a dead short. And we're standing there looking at it going, There's nothing wrong. You're looking at it, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing arced. There's no hole in anything. And I took a look down, and you know how on those glass capacitors, how you can look down and see the you can kind of see between the plates?
Yeah.
There was this itsy bitsy, teeny tiny copper bridge.
We got
hit by lightning. I'm looking at it. No. With an RF bridge, it was measuring a dead short, and we put an ohmmeter across it for fun, and it was 0 ohms. It was like, well, I think we found the problem, but, 22 capacitors later.
Yeah. Well, of course. It couldn't have been, like, number two.
Oh, God forbid. Anyway, we've been chatting here for an hour, guys.
Excellent. Wow.
Yeah.
I hope it was entertaining.
We have fulfilled our contractual obligations then.
You bet we did. Yeah, that was good. We talked about the new cell phones, and we've talked about some problems with our DAs, and some stuff about the moment of methods proof, and the black magic that is AMRF. Chris Tarr, I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
Of course, had a good time.
Yeah, Chris Tobin, always a pleasure to be chatting with you.
Oh, same here. It was a great time. I hope everybody enjoyed it. And any questions, feel free to email us.
Yes, we're all around. Chris Tarr, why don't you tell us where somebody could send you a note?
All you have to do is check out my site at thegeekjedi.com.
Chris Tobin?
Oh, just ctobin@cbs.com.
Or you can find me at either tomray@wr710.com or tom@w2trr.com. That's my ham call. This has been This Week in Radio Tech. We did not have a video component this week, unfortunately, but I hope you found the audio only a little easier on the eyes.
Exactly.
We
got
do
a
this,
face for radio.
Yeah, exactly. We do this every week, and hope you find it not only entertaining but informative. That's what we try to do. If you go to the This Week in Radio Tech website, thisweekinradiotech.com, you can give us some ideas of what you might like to see for future topics and future programs. So, Kirk, hope you made it to Hong Kong in one piece and safely. And we shall all be together next week. Same place, same time. I'm Tom Ray. Have a good evening. This has been This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.